The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Dennis O'Hare, and before we start this edition of The Political Breakfast, just a quick reminder, while you depend on WABE for stories and programs and features like Political Breakfast, WABE depends on you and the rest of the Atlanta community. Your support keeps us going for you. So, during our fall fund drive, please make a gift of support if you can, in whatever amount works for you these days. Every gift counts. Just go to wabe.org/donate, and thank you. Early voting surge continued this week in Georgia, and there was another wave of visits by folks at the top of the presidential campaigns. Unfortunately, while there has not been a surge in new coronavirus cases, they haven't dropped lately either. And in some places, schools are telling students and parents it's still not safe to go back to in-person learning. We hope you're safe and well, and we welcome you to this edition of The Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson are both doing paid work on campaigns that we are talking about this time. So, filling in for Brian, former Georgia Republican Congressman Lynn Westmoreland. And in for Theron, Nabila Islam, a former Democratic candidate for Congress in the 7th District. Glad to have you both.
Thanks so much. Glad to be back.
Yeah, it's good to be back with you, Dennis. I'm glad to be on your show.
Well, thanks to you both for being here, and I'm sure Theron and Brian are listening. Last week, it was President Trump. This week, it's Democratic vice presidential nominee Senator Kamala Harris visiting Atlanta, just a few days after her husband, Doug Emhoff, stopped by. And there have been lots of other family members on both sides coming in and out. But Nabila, do you think that Senator Harris specifically would have come here had Republican Senator David Perdue, who's in a tight race of his own, not mangled her name during President Trump's visit?
Oh, absolutely. Georgia is on the map. It is a battleground state this year, and potentially will flip blue. I think it will. Now, Senator Perdue butchering her name was just unacceptable, and he knows how to pronounce Senator Harris's name on purpose, butchered it, which I think is going to really hurt him in his election.
Congressman, do you think that Senator Harris would have come here had it not been for David Perdue?
I do believe that. Georgia's definitely becoming more of a battleground state, and it made just perfect political sense for the senator to come here and campaign. Very popular with groups here in the state. And I think Senator Perdue, I mean, mispronouncing the name is one thing, but how he handled it to me was not a very good way of how to handle it.
And in a couple of our recent podcasts, Lynn, Brian has noted how Republicans are trying to win some voters of color, particularly in Gwinnett County, among members of the South Asian community, which Nabila knows well, of course. Do you think that Senator Perdue, through an unforced error here, undermined those efforts at the worst possible time?
I think people pay attention to how you handle a mistake. And I think the senator did a real poor job. He was at a red meat rally, so I think he thought he was being funny. But that 7th district is probably the most diverse. No, it's not probably. It is the most diverse district that we have in Georgia. And a lot of those ethnic groups, somebody's name is very, very important to them and how it's pronounced and in the sequence that it's done. So it possibly could. I don't know how many people were paying attention to it when it actually happened, but the media coming out about it, I think, is maybe the bigger issue.
So I am a 7th district voter and happen to be South Asian. I am the daughter of Bangladeshi immigrants, and my name is Nabila Islam. And yes, our names are very much part of our identities, and someone that willingly mispronunciates or butchers it the way that Senator Perdue does is incredibly offensive to our communities. As I have repeatedly told when I was running for Congress that Nabila Islam is an American name and so is Kamala's. This is if you guys recall, Senator George Allen, when he called that tracker Makaka, instead of calling him by his own name, that really did him in and he lost his election. And I think that this is Senator Perdue's George Allen moment. And I think it was very poor judgment for him to do that, especially in such an increasingly diverse state. And people found it offensive, not just here, but all across the country, that a senator would do that to another fellow senator. And it really spoke a lot about, you know, pronouncing someone's name is also giving that person respect. And it was very disrespectful to our ethnic communities.
Let's pick up on the drive that Brian referred to of Republicans trying to win voters, particularly in the South Asian community. Nabila, I'll start with you since you were addressing some of those same voters in your campaign. Have Republicans at least gotten folks in the South Asian community there to listen?
The South Asian community, look, we're not a monolith, but with that being said, the Gwinnett County is a working class county, and a lot of South Asians on the ground are, you know, worried about being able to afford a healthcare, worried about jobs, wages, and our immigration policies and how people of color are unfairly targeted. And like 20% of the 7th district are foreign born. There's been a lot of, you know, xenophobia, especially from coming down from Donald Trump and his administration. That rhetoric does not help. It otherizes us, and it's an us versus them messaging coming from Republicans. And that's been made very clear to the South Asian community here.
Lynn, how can Republicans reverse that perception?
Well, Dennis, that's a question that a lot of people have been trying to answer for a lot of years about, you know, how do you get into these different ethnic groups with your message? And what I have found is that the only real way to do it is to get somebody from that community to go in and talk to folks about your message. It rings more true from somebody within the community if they will go out and do it, just because you're a Republican trying to persuade somebody to vote for you, you're not going to change them. They either have to see it in your life or they have to hear it from somebody that they know and trust. And so the outreach really needs to be with these community leaders, and then they will go out in the community and ring the bell for you, so to speak.
Yeah, and that is the challenge, which we're going to get to in a moment, about the sort of person-to-person encounters during a pandemic. But right before we get to that, the latest New York Times Siena College poll, like most of the previous polls, shows the presidential race a dead heat here in Georgia. But what the polling does show is also the president is heading in the wrong direction. He had been up a little bit in some of the earlier polling. Now it's pretty much tied according to most all of the polls. I'll start with Lynn here, since both of you have run campaigns where you watch the trends as much as the absolute numbers. Are Republicans worried about the trend here in the presidential race?
polling is not an exact science. A lot of it has to do with, to me, is how the polling is done. In other words, if they say, okay, we're going to do it by population centers, and so Atlanta is 60%, or the Atlanta metro area is 70% of the population. So we are going to put 70% of our poll in the metro Atlanta area. And then the other 30% of participants will come from the rest of Georgia. To me, that gives you a skewed poll. And so without knowing what they're doing and the trend, I just don't believe, because the last 2 weeks of election, of course, you know, with early voting, it's probably not as true now as it was, but the last 2 weeks of an election, to me, is when somebody either has the momentum or they don't. So I think these next 10 days or so is going to be real important to look at who has momentum going into that election day.
I will say that when President Obama ran in 2008, he won about 48% of the state. And so I think that there's a potential that we actually do flip this year with Joe Biden's campaign actually investing in the state of Georgia with staffers on the ground. And so Donald Trump he's been a unique president in the sense that he's really pissed off a lot of people, including people within his own party, where a lot of white suburban men have left the Republican Party and can't fathom voting for Donald Trump again after seeing who he really was after these 4 years. And I think it's going to be a tough election for Donald Trump to win his presidency again, and then also to win Georgia.
Those voters now, I think, with the economy, you can argue what you want to, but the economy is, I'm a lot better off than I was 4 years ago. And so I think a lot of those same voters may have gotten over the personality differences and are looking at their life more now than they are the personal things that the president, I mean, I don't know if you ever get used to people offending people, but I don't think it's the same dynamic that it was in 2016 for some of these voters.
You bring up a really interesting point, and I want to quickly get some thoughts from both of you on this, because one of the things I've seen in some of the polls that I've looked at is exactly what Congressman Westmoreland just said, that people, a plurality anyway, of people in a lot of the polls say they are better off than they were 4 years ago, but they also say the country is not. So that's a really interesting dichotomy. And Nabil, I'll start with you. Do we know which way voters like that, who think they're better off, but the country isn't, which is going to be the driving motivator for them?
I really think that racial tensions in this country are at an all-time high. In the fact that when Donald Trump, in his last in-person debate with Vice President Joe Biden, would not denounce white supremacy, was a shock to, I think, most people. And I feel like that we've lost a sense of normal that we've had. And I feel like this president is more like a cartoon, and every day it's something new. And it's like people are just feeling jerked around constantly. You know, the congressman mentioned that he's better off now than he was 4 years ago, but the majority of Americans today are still living paycheck to paycheck. We've lost tens of millions of jobs because of this pandemic. Over 210,000 people are dead, are no longer with their families. And also, because we tie healthcare to employment, millions have lost their health insurance during a pandemic. So I think a lot of these factors are going to be considered. And that's why I really do think that if you are undecided, you're more likely to vote for a Biden-Harris ticket.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the president has denounced white supremacists. I don't know how many times he has to say it or if he's got to write it in blood somewhere, but that message is just not ringing with people that he's never denounced that, which he has. But this president is so unique in so many different ways than any other president that we've had. And you know, whether you like his business dealings or not, he understands what makes the economy tick.
And speaking of the last days of a campaign, of course, as we all have mentioned, we're seeing more of the rallies and more of the attention to them. But for all of that, according to Emory University political scientist Professor Andrew Gillespie, they're no substitute for doing the hard work of canvassing and phone banking. And she was one of the guests on our recent live community event here at WABE. And here's what she said about that.
At the end of the day, if somebody does all rallies, but they're not actually doing phone banking or canvassing behind the scenes, I actually would think that they probably wasted their money on glitzy shows and they didn't actually do the nuts and bolts, meat and potatoes kind of work that you need to do in order to drive up voter turnout. So yeah, it's great for enthusiasm. It's great to, you know, get your most ardent volunteers excited so that they can go out and do the hard work. But at the end of the day, you can't win an election just on rallies.
You both have been candidates, of course. Nabila, you've not only been a candidate recently, before that, you did a lot of work on campaigns. So, two-part question. Is the professor right when she says rallies themselves won't get you there? But also, and you would know this from your own recent experience, isn't it hard to do that groundwork of turnout and phone banking and canvassing in a pandemic?
I first, agree with the professor. Rallies won't just get you there. You have to, you know, do the work on the ground, which pre-pandemic would have meant, you know, knocking on doors, shaking hands, you know, going to meet and greets, having a full-scale operation, field operation, targeting your voters and making sure that they have everything that they need in order to vote. The best form of paid communication is person-to-person contact. And during a pandemic, in March, late March, I shut down my field office because I didn't think it was responsible to put my staffers' health in risk and also my community's. So we quickly shifted to a virtual campaign, which is something that I wasn't used to. But as a millennial, we were pretty savvy on social media, but it was still very hard because your electorate's getting used to being communicated through Zoom calls and Skypes and join me on Facebook Lives. You know, not everyone is tech savvy. It does hurt campaigning a little bit, I would say. Another thing I would comment is I've recently seen Republicans are out knocking on doors. And I think they're capitalizing on the fact that Democrats don't want to put the health of, you know, people in jeopardy. And so we'll have to see how that plays out. But it's been a weird election. And I hope that in the next coming years, we can go back to campaigning like we used to.
Well, I was just going to say that President Obama set the standard for campaigning. He was a machine, and his campaign was a machine. And, you know, you talking about door-to-door canvassing, the best technology, he ran circles around the Republicans. I mean, circles as far as making that personal contact, you know, where it was in large housing units, neighborhoods, or whatever. He had canvassers out there, and they could connect real time to his national campaign about what the voter standing in front of them said. You can't do that anymore. And it makes the campaigning really, really hard. And doing it virtual, I think people, even though they went through that spurt of all this online, you know, buying and stuff, I do think that people now are going back to, I want to touch that product. I want to see it. And I think campaigning and who they're going to vote for a candidate is the same thing. And that's the reason I think the rallies, look, Professor Gillespie, I've been on panels with her. She's very smart, but I think the rallies give people an opportunity and go to see the person live. And where they get to sit down to talk with him or her, I think it makes a difference to see them in person. But Nabila has just came out of a campaign that was virtual. I can't imagine doing it. I cannot imagine doing that because I'm more of the shake their hand, kiss the baby, personal contact kind of campaigner. And that's, you know, out of all the campaigns I've ran, that personal contact to me was the most important.
Well, we've talked about the race for Senator Perdue's seat a little bit. We'll talk some more about that and about the other Senate race and a couple of congressional races, too. That and more when the Political Breakfast continues. Stay right here.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Thank you very much for being with us. Joining us this time, filling in for Theron Johnson and Brian Robinson, respectively, we have former 7th District Democratic congressional candidate Nabila Islam and former Republican Georgia Congressman Lynn Westmoreland. Let's take a look at the race for the seat held by Senator Loeffler. Now, this is the one where all the candidates, Democrats and Republicans, are on the same ballot. Another poll shows Congressman Doug Collins, a Republican, trailing Senator Kelly Loeffler as they chase Democrat Pastor Raphael Warnock. And this week, the insults really started flying. State House Speaker David Ralston said, among other things, that Senator Loeffler had, in his words, married well. Her husband owns the company that owns the New York Stock Exchange. Lynn Westmoreland, I'll start with you. Was that a mistake for Speaker Ralston, and by implication for Congressman Collins, in a campaign where women could hold the key?
Look, it doesn't matter what you say. Somebody's going to make something out of it. You can try to be as nice as you can. And I'm not sure what context the speaker said that. But the other thing he said, if I read it right, was the fact that most suburban women do not relate to Senator Loeffler. There's not many suburban women that I've ever met that take a jet to work every day. And so his comment, the people that are for Kelly are going to make a big deal out of it. The people that are for Doug are going to try to downplay it the best they can. And the women, I think you're exactly right, Dennis, but the polls that I've seen really show that Senator Loeffler has a lower favorable than Congressman Collins with women. I thought that was pretty telling that, you know, when the woman candidate has less favorable than the male opponent, that was pretty interesting. And so I think that a lot of the suburban women don't associate with her.
And I was about to ask Nabila about that. Senator Loeffler's unfavorables, as you mentioned, are bigger than Congressman Collins's, and that does show up, at least according to the polls, among female voters. And this despite all of her ads that were introducing her to voters. Nabila, Democrats are watching this. And I asked this of Michael Owens, the former Cobb Democratic chair, in our last podcast. Do Democrats think that if there's a runoff, and it looks like there will be, that she, for all of her money, might be more vulnerable?
I don't think anyone likes Loeffler, including the Republicans in this state. And that's why her unfavorable is so high. And it's telling that she's invested so much of her own money in the tens of millions of dollars, and she still hasn't been able to significantly move her numbers. I don't think her messaging is working. I think Governor Brian Kemp made a mistake in appointing her. I think originally the intent was that she was going to help attract suburban women. But I agree with the congressman that I don't know any suburban women that take a jet anywhere. She's just not relatable. She doesn't represent the, you know, typical American Georgian story. And so I think that if she does get into a runoff with, which will likely be Reverend Warnock, she's going to have a hard time. She's going to have a hard time because she's been running a really hard right primary campaign, and that's going to catch up to her in a general election.
But both candidates in a runoff are going to have a lot of outside money from their parties. Will it matter what's happened in the past when they have all of that money to drive turnout, to excite people about possible control of the Senate, and to kind of put whatever was in the past behind them. And Nabila, I'll start with you.
Well, I think Democrats will take that money and remind people of who Loeffler was a month ago. Like I said, I think all the actions that she's taken throughout this year, whether it was her profiting off the pandemic with, you know, insider knowledge that she had, or it's been her out of touch things that she said about Black Lives Matter. There's so many things that you can hit her on at this point. She's just made herself, in my opinion, a laughingstock. And then her messaging has been really weird in terms of her ads. I don't understand if they're trying to be funny, but I don't think it moves anyone. I just think that even if you gave her a bunch of money, she's still going to miss the mark, because she doesn't understand the lives of normal people.
It sounds, Nabila, just to sum up, that you're one Democrat who thinks that maybe she would be the preferable opponent to Congressman Collins in a runoff.
Yes, definitely. I think if Congressman Collins makes the runoff, he'd be more of a problem for Democrats. He's more relatable. He's been pretty good on his positive messaging about who he is. I would much rather Loeffler make it into the runoff.
Well, I think the last numbers I heard, she has spent over $32 million in advertising. I think she went on the air right after she was sworn in. So $32 million, I think that the Collins campaign has spent maybe $2 million. And so, you know, I go back to Roy Barnes and Sonny Perdue. You know, Barnes had $22 million in the bank, and Sonny was struggling, you know, to raise money because Governor Barnes was pretty simple on his message when he was trying to raise money, and he just didn't have it. So I think Governor Perdue spent about $5 million. Governor Barnes spent $22 million, and I think it was about a 6 or 7 point race. Money is not going to buy somebody's impression of who you are. And Nabila's right. When you see her on a commercial with a baseball hat on, it's almost laughable to me. I mean, it really is. I would like to go to her neighbors, if they've ever seen her, and say, how many times have you seen her out in the yard with a baseball hat on? And the fact that she made a big deal out of going to a dealership. In fact, I think she did a YouTube going to the dealership and buying a Kia from an African-American salesman and making the comment, I can't wait to travel Georgia in my Kia. I mean, I don't. That's hard for me to believe that anybody is going to believe that if somebody's worth $900 million. I don't know how else to put it, Dennis, but her campaigning, the $32 million, hadn't moved the numbers. And I think if she got another $32 million, I don't know that it would move the numbers. And as far as the runoff goes, think about this for a minute. Let's say the Senate is 50-50 in, or whatever, and this race is going to decide whether Republicans have the majority in the Senate or not. $100, $200, $300 million will be coming into the state for this race. And at this point in time, it's still the South, and I don't think money's going to make a big difference in how the election turns out.
Just from both of you, as fast as you can, starting with Nabila, do you think that in both of these races, Pastor Warnock and John Ossoff, to turn to the Democrats for a moment, really do have to win outright and go all in on trying to win on November 3rd instead of risking a runoff?
Yeah, I think they need to win outright without a runoff. And traditionally, Democrats have lower turnout when in comparison to Republicans when it comes to runoff elections. And so if we can make our case now, that would be wonderful. But I see a higher chance of John Ossoff beating Perdue and not getting into a runoff than I do Reverend Warnock. So I think that race, Reverend Warnock's race, will probably end up in a runoff in January.
I agree. No, I totally agree. If you're looking at who's got the best chances of winning November 3rd, it's definitely John, because with 17 or 18 people in that jungle primary, nobody's going to get 50%.
Let's look again now at the rematch in the 6th U.S. House District, north of Atlanta. Democratic Congresswoman Lucy McBath faces Republican former Congresswoman Karen Handel, who lost to McBath 2 years ago. Lynn, I'll start with you. The Cook Political Report recently shifted its estimate of this race in McBath's favor. Looking at it, do you think that's about right, and what might be behind that?
Well, the Cook Report is about as confusing as a termite on a yo-yo. I mean, you can look at his, they used to be a lot more dependable than what they are now when Mr. Cook was doing all this himself, maybe in his office or whatever, but he's got such a large staff now, and they're, to me, they're just trying to get way too technical with how they look at this. I think Karen has a good shot at taking the seat back, but I think a lot of it is going to depend on those voters that we were originally, you know, talking about, Dennis. Are they better off today than they were 4 years ago? Have they come to accept the fact that the president maybe looked at it as a bully and all these other things, but has he performed to what they would consider a standard that has made the country and theirself better? And I think if they go out and vote for Trump, that I definitely think that Karen wins this. If they don't, I don't see any way she can.
And Nabila, on that point, your district, the 7th, is right next door to the 6th. And this race was so close 2 years ago. In this election, does Congresswoman McBath have to run ahead of the top of her own ticket, ahead of Vice President Biden, in order to win, since it's possible you could have some Biden-Handel voters?
Lucy McBath is going to win her reelection. I mean, the Cook Political Report has ranked it likely Democrat. I just don't think Karen Handel's message is resonating with the district. She's been a career politician for almost 2 decades now, and she's never served a full term. Voters are going to reject her again at the ballot box, and so this administration has lost suburban white women, and there is a large population of voting suburban white women in Lucy McBath's district. So if they did vote for Trump last time, I don't think they're voting for Trump again. It will stay blue, and the 7th will flip blue this year as well.
Nabila makes a good point about the suburban women, but the one issue that was not in the election 2 years ago is the issue of safety. Do you feel safe in your home? Is your property protected? And I think the Democrats have done a very, very poor job on their messaging as far as the violence and the riots and the just the unrest. And I think the Democrats have done a terrible job in answering that. And so I think a lot of suburban women that maybe didn't vote for Trump because of his crassness and the way he handled himself 4 years ago may look at it now and go, you know what? He makes me feel safer in my house and my community than what Vice President Biden would make me feel in his administration.
Nabila, actually, that was the point I was going to go to, not to oversimplify what the campaigns have done, but the big issue that you hear in their ads on the Republican side, it is, as Congressman Westmoreland just said, law and order. On Lucy McBath's side, it's primarily health care and the Affordable Care Act and pre-existing conditions and also gun safety. So are voters going to be choosing between those two conflicting priorities, if you will, when safety and health care are important to everybody?
Under a Republican administration, we've seen millions of people lose their health care. In fact, Donald Trump is trying to overturn the ACA and remove protections from people with pre-existing conditions. And I feel like the Democrats have done a great job at messaging that if, you know, Karen Handel wins or if Donald Trump wins his reelection, that's going to take away health care from millions of people that have it now. And I've seen those ads because I'm in the Atlanta media market that Karen Handel has put up about trying to use fear as a motivator that folks are less safe with Lucy McBath. But let's remind people that Lucy McBath is a Black woman who won an election in a predominantly white district running on gun control because her son was murdered by a racist white man. She is absolutely going to make sure that her constituents are protected. In fact, making sure that her constituents feel safe has been a huge priority of hers. And I think she's done a great job in messaging that and making sure her voters know that.
The statement that millions of people have lost their health care since this president has been in office is not true. Or at least the statement that million more are going to lose their health care if he's reelected. That is just not true. And I don't believe the facts are there to back it up. And if you look at what, you know, he's trying to do with drug costs and calling out these companies that have made billions and billions of dollars off the American people, that they would have an opportunity to get drugs somewhere else at a cheaper price. I just don't think those things are true. And it goes back to the old saying, you know, if you say it enough times, it will be true. But those statements just aren't true. And I don't know where those facts have come from.
Let me move to the 7th district, because some of those issues also prevail there. GOP candidate Dr. Rich McCormick got the endorsement of a fellow Republican candidate and likely Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's the nominee in the heavily Republican 14th district in Northwest Georgia. Now, Marjorie Taylor Greene has expressed support in the past for the baseless QAnon conspiracy theory. Lynn, I'll start with you. That's probably not an endorsement that Dr. McCormick really needs in a tight Metro Atlanta suburban race, is it?
You know, Dennis, in 2010, when Congressman McCarthy and I were traveling the country, you know,
you're talking about Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, right?
Right. Yeah. And we were looking for candidates. And the reason we traveled is that we tried to get a feel for the district and who best matched up with not the total party, but with the district. Rich McCormick, he's a great guy and he's got a great resume. But Rob Woodall, Nabilo's probably not going to agree with this, but he did such a great job with constituent services. He went to every ribbon cutting of every minority business up there. He attended their dinners, their lunches, their special events, their weddings. To me, Rob Woodall was the perfect candidate, perfect Republican candidate for that district.
Just so everybody knows, he is the congressman who is retiring.
Yes. Not that I didn't beg him for a year not to do that, because I felt like he could actually hold that seat. But that district is candidate driven. It's not a red meat district. It's a very candidate, community driven district. I don't know that the right Democrat won that primary, just like the right Republican. But if you put Rich McCormick on a national stage, he'd be A+. You put him as a candidate in that particular district, and I don't know. But I'm not sure the Democrat, the nominee there, is the right candidate either.
Well, we have somebody who can certainly address that. Nabila, go ahead.
I will comment about Rob Woodall. I felt that he was a lazy politician. He wasn't as present as he could have been. He really felt his absence in the district. And I think that goes to show you that he increasingly felt uncomfortable with the district that didn't look like the district that he was elected into in 2010. It's one of the most diverse districts in the entire country. Gwinnett County itself is the fourth most diverse county in the entire country as well. And, you know, I've always said that communities that look like mine should be represented by people that reflect their diversity and their values. And I am really excited for Carolyn Bordeaux to beat Dr. Rich McCormick on Election Day. And he's been really out of touch with some of the things he's said. He got that coveted endorsement from Marjorie Greene. And he himself has actually repeated some QAnon conspiracies himself. And so, you know, in a district that, like you said, is very community oriented, it's not a red meat district, he's aligned himself really closely with Donald Trump. And I think that was a mistake. And I'm positive that this district is going to flip blue and we'll finally have, you know, Democratic representation that understands the issues on the ground.
Let's shift now to the latest on COVID-19 in Georgia, because that could certainly affect elections. New cases and the rate of positive tests are still flat in Georgia, according to the latest report from the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Our WABE colleague Sam Whitehead obtained that. One of the biggest problems continues to be community spread in small social gatherings, according to the task force. Lynn, the report mentions spread by people who are asymptomatic, and that's the issue that Governor Kemp referred to back in the spring as a game changer for him. But he hasn't talked as much, at least in public, about that part of it since, or at least he hasn't appeared to. Is he missing a chance to get out front more loudly and more often in getting that message out?
I really appreciate what the governor has done as far as keeping Georgia open. You know, maybe he could go out more and talk about people wearing a mask. I think the episode with President Trump getting it at the gathering for Judge Barrett made people realize that, hey, this mask thing's a little bit more important than, you know, what people say or what people have said. And so from that standpoint, yeah, I mean, I think the governor could be out there more, but he doesn't want to be like a Cuomo and, you know, have this big press conference every day. But every time I've seen the governor, he's had on his mask. You know, my wife stayed on me for months about wearing a mask, and I just didn't do it. I wear a mask now. So, yeah, there is probably more he could do, but I think him being an example of wearing a mask, getting out, in the conversations he does have, he encourages people to do it, but he's not going to make it a mandate. And, I mean, this is all about personal responsibility. My wife's got pre-existing conditions that would make it worse for her with the COVID. And so out of my respect for her, I've just started continually wearing the mask. And I think the masks are important. I'll go on record saying that. And I think that people should, but I don't think it should be dictated.
Oh, I definitely think it should be dictated. You know, the governor himself, he has not worn a mask at bigger campaign gatherings that he's had. As the governor of the state, he needs to lead by example. I think a lot of people are looking at him and seeing that he's not taking it as seriously as he could be. I mean, look at the state of Texas. They have a mask mandate and their governor is a Republican governor. I've seen a lot of folks not take wearing a mask seriously. And when you are wearing a mask, you are protecting other people from yourself. If I am immunocompromised and someone doesn't feel like wearing a mask because they don't want to, they're putting my health at risk. And I can't do anything about that. We should implement a mask mandate, point blank.
In our recent live community event on Facebook Live, which you can check out on our Facebook page at WABE, by the way, Fulton County Elections Director Richard Barron mentioned 23 cases in the election division warehouse. And so they're having to train new workers as they go to replace the ones who've had to quarantine. So I'll start, Nabila, with you. How big of a worry is COVID for every campaign everywhere as we get toward Election Day?
It's a huge worry. And that's why people have been encouraging folks to vote via absentee, because we don't want to compromise, you know, the health of voters by making them wait in 8-hour long lines like that we saw in Gwinnett County. Our absentee ballots here in Gwinnett have been delayed because our county elections delayed having them made by an outside vendor. And so there are people right now that requested ballots back in August that still don't have one. I had someone reach out to me and said, my mother is immunocompromised. She requested her ballot 2 months ago, still doesn't have it, but she will wait in line if she has to. And that's just sad that it's come to this point.
We asked Gabe Sterling from the Secretary of State's office that very question during our recent live event. And he said that backlog is clearing up now and people in Gwinnett are starting to get their absentee ballots. Are you hearing that as well, that late as it may be, the ballots are beginning to get there?
I have been told that people have been calling the Gwinnett County Elections Board and telling them that I have not received my ballot. And they said, we will reissue another one. You will receive it in 7 to 10 days. The election is 2 weeks from now. So I wouldn't even feel comfortable mailing it back at this point. You're going to have to drop it off at one of those ballot drop boxes. But there are an outstanding number of people that are still waiting on those ballots. So I think it's unacceptable that if you requested a ballot back in the beginning of August and you don't have it until a week before Election Day, that's why our early voting numbers here in Gwinnett are lower than other counties, is because people haven't received their ballots yet. This is a big problem that we need to address.
Congressman Westmoreland, COVID and campaigns and anything else from what Nabila said that you want to get to?
The election's November 3rd, and hopefully by Easter of 2021, we'll know who the president is and what the makeup of the Senate and the House is going to be. November 3rd is just a national election day. We're not going to know who the president is or members of Congress or state representatives or anybody else for quite some time. And the fact is that there will be so many lawsuits. And my good friend and my second son, Brian Tyson, will probably be making more money than any of us ever dreamed of because of all the election law lawsuits that are going to be filed after November 3rd. The absentee ballot thing has been a fiasco from the start, Dennis. During the primary, and Nabila may know this, but during the primary, my daughter was on the ballot. And I was at one of the polling places holding up a sign, and people came by and said, hey, they wouldn't let me vote. Why wouldn't they let you vote? Well, because I had ordered an absentee ballot, but I decided I was just going to come vote in person. And they said that I had gotten an absentee ballot. And I said, yeah, but I didn't use it. So rather than letting them do a provisional ballot, they just told them they couldn't vote. Now, I think that was eventually corrected.
Yeah, the Secretary of State's office has said that there are now folks who can help you on site cancel your absentee ballot and go vote.
Right. Look, I think they're working on it as fast as they can, but to have this virus hit in a presidential election year has made it even tougher.
It's not only tough for voters with COVID these days, it's tough for students and parents in school districts all over the state. Atlanta Public Schools and the DeKalb School District both decided in this past week to postpone returning to in-person learning because the COVID-19 case rates are not dropping. And this has restarted the debate over whether the dangers of in-person learning are overstated or not. But Lynn, I'll start with you on this one. With questions about whether our data, even now, accurately reflect the real rate of infection, it's hard to even have that debate about school safety, isn't it? I mean, it's still totally uncertain for parents and students.
Dennis, you're right. And the other thing that comes into this is the accuracy of the test and the accuracy of the science about how long does it take you to develop the disease once you've been exposed, and then how long you need to be quarantined that you don't expose somebody else. And as far as our school kids go, I think that's having an impact on our economy and the fact that we have a lot of homes that are two-parent working homes. And rather than the child being in school, they're either having to pay to have a nanny or one of the parents had to quit their job so they could be at home. Some of my grandkids have a special need for in-person learning. They're just not going to do good with virtual. And, you know, you take a child that's got ADD or whatever the attention deficit is, and you put him in front of a computer, if he's lucky enough to have one, that kid's not going to learn. And I don't know how many kids in the inner city that doesn't have a computer. And Dennis, this is 2020, and I don't have high-speed internet. So every young person on this road that I live on that is trying to virtual learn does not have high-speed internet.
Doesn't this go back, though, to the question that critics of the Trump administration and even Governor Kemp's administration here have raised about a consistent, centralized, unified response to COVID?
I think that the response has been as unified as it could be. I mean, this is something that I think everybody knew could happen, but I don't think the planning had gone into this like it should have been. And this administration had to replenish all of these medical supplies, the personal protection equipment. They had to make sure that more ventilators were built. Those had not been replenished. And so I think they've done a great job. And I mean, 200,000 people have died, and I hate that. And I've had some friends that died. But I've also had people that have died that said they died of COVID that didn't actually die of COVID. They had a lung disease, lung cancer, or whatever it is. So, I mean, Dennis, nobody knows what to believe. They just don't know. And so, I mean, America's running around confused.
I think America's running around confused because Donald Trump and this administration haven't been forthright in, first of all, in how deadly this airborne disease is. And it turns out Donald Trump knew back in February that COVID-19 was going to be a bigger threat to the lives of the American people. And he downplayed it, called it a hoax. I think Brian Kemp mirrored Donald Trump and his actions because he so much wants to be in his good graces. And so fellow Georgians had to pay for the inactions of Brian Kemp. And that's why we're one of the last states to issue a shutdown and one of the first states to reopen. When it comes to school openings, you know, there are schools that are withholding information about how many cases have transpired within their school system. That information is not as accessible as it should be to the public. Parents can't make informative decisions about protecting the lives of their children. More than anything, we want to go back to normal. We want to go back to not having to worry about if the person next to you possibly has COVID-19, but they're not exhibiting symptoms, that our kids can go back to school, that we can all go back to work and hang out with our friends and have lunch and brunch. But that is not going to happen anytime soon at the pace of how we're addressing things in this state. And at the end of the day, and I've said this repeatedly, you can bring back an economy, but you can't bring back the life of a loved one. And we shouldn't have to sacrifice our children, our teachers, our elderly, just because we want to reopen businesses. We can do this responsibly, and we have yet to see those actions take place.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Former Republican Georgia Congressman Lynn Westmoreland filled in for GOP strategist Brian Robinson this time, substituting for Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, Nabila Islam, a progressive activist, founder of the Progressive List, and former Democratic candidate for Congress in the 7th District. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure to be with you again, Dennis, and nice to meet you, Congressman.
Same here, Dennis. Thanks for having me on the show. Nabila, it's great to have the conversation with you, and I look forward to meeting you in person one day. And Dennis, I hope you'll have us back.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Lynn is at Westmoreland_GA. Nabila is at NABILAH for GA07. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale, that's TINSDALE. Theron is at Theron Johnson, and I'm at DENISOHAYER. Our thanks to Kevin Rinker and Christopher Alston for their production assistance. And if you like this show, please subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. And why not check out all of the other great podcasts from WABE? Up-to-the-minute information on the coronavirus, on Did You Wash Your Hands with Sam Whitehead, a deep dive into the politics and money in one corner of the gun debate, Lisa Hagen brings you No Compromise, and then the new season of the Peabody Award-winning Buried Truths with Hank Klibanoff unearthing details about the murder of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick. And here on Political Breakfast, we'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us and have a great and a safe week, and don't forget to vote.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.